Time, all participants are in listen-only mode. If you require any operator assistance during the program, please press star then zero. I would now like to introduce your host for this conference call, Mr. Scott Bernstein. You may begin, sir.
All right, Kevin, thank you so much. Good afternoon, everybody. I'm Scott Bernstein. I'm the Eastern Divisional for DWS. I just want to start by saying thank you for joining us this afternoon. It's 2 o'clock on the East Coast, and it's a beautiful 80-degree sunny day, so really, really pleased that you all could take the time out of your schedules to be with us today. As we decide to take a look inside the ropes in Washington and kind of take a look at the landscape. And I was just talking to Frank as we jumped on here. It's what has probably been the most polarizing time in at least my lifetime to just kind of watch what's going on politically, the landscape, what's happening, all the things, what it means, how to try to make sense of it all, and just kind of see where this sort of thing ends up. So we're going to go inside the ropes today and have a nice conversation with Frank Kelly. So I've got two things I want to share with you before I introduce Frank and bring him on the line. First off, on behalf of all the advisors, I just want to thank you for joining us. And I want to say, one, the goal of the call today is to just give you as much insight into Washington and kind of the political landscape, if you will, so that you can have a conversation with your advisors and decide what sort of things should we be doing if the Democrats win or the Republicans win or if this happens or if that happens. You're able to have those conversations and have a plan in place, just in case whatever it might be the turnout is. And then secondly, just a quick introduction around our firm. I'll mention just a quick few things before I bring Frank on. DWS, we're European-based. We're a large asset manager. We run $850 billion roughly, so we're large when it comes to scale from a scale standpoint. And we've been fortunate. We have great momentum. We've been recognized by a lot of third parties. I just want to highlight that a little bit. Number one, you might be familiar with the magazine Barron's. Barron's is a very well-read industry magazine. Most advisors follow this. We all follow this. What's interesting about Barron's is they do an annual kind of survey of the best asset managers in the industry. And in the year of 2019, they ranked DWS number three, the number three asset manager in the industry. That's our highest ranking, something we're really proud of. They also ranked us number four in fixed income. That's overall taxable and tax-free. And then they also ranked us number two in taxable fixed income. So when you look at our asset base under $850 billion, the fixed income component is about a third of that, and that's something that's part of our DNA. Another part of our organization that's part of our DNA is ESG, which is sustainable investing, something that is becoming more and more relevant, and you're hearing more and more about. Two other third parties recognized us when it comes to ESG investing. So Morningstar, you might be familiar with Morningstar. They're the folks that put the five stars on mutual funds and ETFs and tell you that these are great products. Well, they ranked us the number one fund of asset manager when it comes to ESG. And also Credit Suisse, their research arm, also ranked us number one when it comes to ESG. So a couple things that are part of our DNA, some of the third parties that are recognizing us, and we've been fortunate. We have a lot of great momentum when it comes to that from an industry standpoint. But today is really about going inside the ropes and having a conversation with Frank Kelly regarding politics and what's happening within politics. So for the next 15 or 20 minutes, I'll turn the call over to him. We'll hear some comments from him, and then I have some questions that your advisors had sent up on your behalf to be answered, so we'll have some dialogue from that standpoint as well. But to formally introduce Frank, he represents DWS. He's head of government and public affairs for North and Latin Americas. And basically what he does is he manages and coordinates relationships with elected officials. So he meets with congressmen, he meets with senators, he knows these folks. He works with legislative bodies globally, of course. And then before joining the private sector, he served in the SEC as chief spokesman. He also worked for the Department of Justice, and where he focused on international matters, including terrorism and war crimes. And prior to these posts, he served both in the George H.W. Bush administration and the Reagan White House, where he started as a writer for President Reagan. So with that formal introduction, Frank, I will, one, thank you for joining. Two, I will turn the call over to you if you wouldn't mind spending the next 15 to 20 just giving us your insights and what you think is relevant and what we should be thinking about. And then I have some prepared questions that have come from some of our clients that are on the line that maybe we can have a conversation around as well. So thanks for joining, and I'll turn the call over to you.
Thanks, Scott, and thank you, everybody, for joining today. I'm sure it's been sort of, for so many of us, it's been a rough year, right? I mean, it's the best of times and the worst of times. I think it A Tale of Two Cities by Dickens started out. And but we're getting through it, hopefully. And I hope all of you are healthy and keeping hopeful, because we will get through it we'll be the better for it, even how tough it is. Well, we're in the tough time, too, not just of COVID, but it's the elections. And it is as heated as you can imagine. And Scott said, I think none of us can compare it to anything we've ever seen in our lives. And where are we now and where are we going? So first, let me just quickly say, I think a lot of people are wondering what's happening here with stimulus, for example, and what happened and what can we expect. It's a very interesting debate internally. It's not just sort of stupid politics. It's truly two sides with different philosophies and views here as to who should get aid, how the money should be dispensed, how much, and it's very hard for them to come together on this, right? Should certain states get more money, particularly those that are hard hit, like California, Illinois, New Jersey, New York, who are desperate, but then again have had tough fiscal situations even pre-COVID. And then there's other states who are objecting to that who have also gotten hard hit, Florida, Georgia, Texas. And if you notice, that are pretty stark political lines. They're red versus blue, and that has held up. How much should be given for schools? How much should be given for airlines? This is really a tough moment. And you've got contradictory economic data out there, with a lot of people beginning to say and feel that the economy is coming back. And this then gets you into the whole debate as to whether or not we should be lifting a lot of the lockdowns around. So this gets complication on complication on complication. But quickly, let's get to the elections and where we are now. And just for sources, I think it's fair to you, and you're probably trying to follow all of this. I'm a big believer in following realclearpolitics.com, realclearpolitics.com. It's free, you don't have to sign up. But what it does is it's a great aggregator of polls. State by state, at the presidential level, the Senate races, many of the House races, governor's races, and it gives you a sense of where things are going. I do think the polls are off again. I got to say it right now and be blunt about it. To see, for example, the Wall Street Journal, NBC, came out over the weekend saying that Donald Trump was up by 14. I mean, I'm sorry, that Joe Biden's up by 14 percentage points. What? That would mean that Trump's base had basically collapsed. Second, it's a national poll. We don't vote at a national level. It's always the battleground states: Florida, Pennsylvania, Ohio, Wisconsin, Michigan, increasingly Arizona, North Carolina. And that we saw in 2016, it's all about paths to victory for either side, where Trump 4 years ago won the electoral vote, not the popular vote, and he did it through a very smart calculation of winning and focusing on electoral vote-rich states. You get back to that again, now start looking at the state-by-states. Now, even there, looking at the Real Clear Politics, we're starting to see these weird variations. So, for example, I think it was Pennsylvania I was looking at the other day in Real Clear Politics, and it had Biden up by 6. But then you look at the individual polls that fed into that. Biden up by 3, Biden up by 2, Biden up by 3, Biden up by 12. 12? How did that variance get in there? So I'm now in the position of looking and of the view that when you look at these, all of these polls, and you're trying to sort of figure out the balance, throw out the lowest, throw out the highest, and average what's left. And that's probably the most accurate. Doing that, this race looks like it's actually very close. It's a couple percentage points in most of the key battleground states. I'd add to that that there's a question of the shy voter. And I think it actually exists on both sides, mostly for Trump at this point. If you were a little hesitant telling people 4 years ago you're voting for Trump, you're even more hesitant at this point. You're not telling your spouse, your family, your dog. Much less some stranger who calls you up at dinner time and says, are you going to vote for Trump or Biden? People just are sick of being asked. They'll do what they want in the privacy of the ballot box. So there seems to be, and Bloomberg News has done some research on this, a variance of up to 5 percentage points in polling. 5 percentage points that may be missed for Trump. Well, that makes these state-by-state races a lot closer and where he may be ahead in some of these states. So hang on to your hat. It's going to get a little weird. We're seeing some of these big-ticket numbers, like I mentioned, the Wall Street Journal poll, and there have been other ones. Forget the national polls. They really don't matter. So we think it's a lot closer than it looks. And I mentioned even with Biden, we've gotten information that among Latinos that they are nervous about, they're not sharing who they're going to vote for. When you talk to Biden folks, why is that? Their view is a lot of these people are legal immigrants, but they're here, and this sort of shows the greatness of the United States. Here we can poll anybody, right? We may argue with each other, but we're not going to kill each other. A lot of these people came from countries in Latin America. Somebody starts asking you who you're supporting politically, that can be lethal. Seriously, think about it. They come here, this is new to them. They've maybe even been here 10 years, but culturally, they're just not used to it yet. So that there may be more of a hidden Latin vote for Biden. But at the end of the day, we're going to see. So if you're going to ask me where things are coming out at this point, I think it's slightly leaning towards Biden at the moment. I think the debates, which we'll come back to in a moment, are going to matter, the remaining debates, particularly tonight's vice presidential debate, and I'll explain that. To the Senate, if you'd asked me a week ago, I would have said 60% chance Democrats are going to win control of the Senate. This week, I think it's a jump ball. As with every election, there's always some scandal that breaks out. North Carolina looked like it was going to be a pickup for Democrats, but there was a scandal that broke out on the Democratic candidate there this past weekend. He was sexting, apparently, with his 26-year-old scheduler, which he's married, in the age of Me Too. Oh, boy. So we haven't seen hard polls come out of that yet, since that has sort of really, as it's, bouncing around the state. I've got to think it's going to help the incumbent Tom Tillis considerably. Wait and see there. Other key battleground states, Arizona, Colorado, Iowa, South Carolina, and Maine, Montana. Republicans are improving on almost all of them. I think Republicans will hold Iowa. They're going to hold Montana. South Carolina with Lindsey Graham, and it's a toss-up at this point, but I think Graham pulls it out. Why? Because he's going to become the national face of the Republican Party here on the 12th when he chairs the Senate Judiciary Committee and the confirmation for Amy Barrett for the Supreme Court. That's going to draw in huge amounts of national cash coming into his campaign and support, and also rouse a lot of conservatives and even moderate conservatives in support of Graham, we believe, as he tries to shepherd Barrett through the confirmation process. And so it ends up being a net positive for him. So I think it's leaning towards Republican holding the Senate, but we'll see. And Democrats will continue to hold the House representatives solidly. However, this gets to the stimulus issue. One of the main reasons that Speaker Nancy Pelosi was aggressively pursuing trying to get a deal is that she has 21 moderate Democrats in districts that Donald Trump carried in 2016. And they're getting hammered with, we need a bill. We need some help. Well, she couldn't get it. Let's see how that plays out. And will you see Republicans pick up House seats? Tough to ascertain. And one of the reasons is it's very hard to get polling data on individual congressional races, just because a lot of them can't afford it. It's expensive to do that polling. So right now, and this will probably change in a week, and who knows, even in 24 hours, Democrats hold the House, leaning holding the Senate, leaning Biden winning the presidency. Now, let me get to the elections here, and then I'll come back to the scenarios. I think one thing that's important to know, folks, and look, I don't want to be Mr. Debbie Downer here, but we're going to have delays almost certainly in a number of the races. Why? Because of COVID, because of the mail-in situation. We're seeing a postal service who's doing everything they can and very admirably, and they need more support, and because guys, they're keeping the economy going, right? Here's the post office. If you walk into any of them, they're working on skeletal crews, and they're overwhelmed because we're using them so much for our Amazon deliveries and other online retail deliveries. They're a primary contractor to those services to deliver. The other day I had 4 Amazon packages delivered, 3 of them separate in 3 separate deliveries by the Postal Service truck pulling up. So they've got to deal with that. And now the flood of mail-in votes are coming in. Yes, there's a significant number of mail-ins that are happening now, but everybody procrastinates and they're all going to be dropping them off on election day, which means they're going to be working overtime to process them, meaning timestamp them so that they're valid. This is a problem that they've had. President Trump spoke factually. He was correct when he spoke at this debate, which was quite a mess, of course. But he did point out for the example of Congresswoman Carolyn Maloney, Upper East Side. I think it's the 12th Congressional District. It took like 8 or 10 weeks to figure out who the winner was of a Democratic primary for the exact reasons that I've just laid out. People flooded the post office on election day with their mail-in ballots. And by the time many of them were processed, it was 2 or 3 days later, meaning they're too late. So they show up at the vote counting center and they're discarded. Well, wait a minute. It's a valid. No, it's not. Here comes a lawsuit. Lots of lawsuits. Well, you can see that situation all over the place. And that's the worry here. Only 3 states are counting the ballots as they come in: Florida, North Carolina, and Arizona. The markets are very focused on Florida. Will we see significant victory for Biden or for Trump that you will be a harbinger that you can effectively assume that we won't have a delay here of any significance? I think it's too close to call down there. And those polls are all right now, you think even Real Clear Politics is like 1 or 2 percentage points, too close to call, within the margin of error. So my base case is we should prepare for at least 2 weeks, maybe as long as 7 weeks before a lot of these races are cleared up and we have a clarity to them. It could even be the presidential. And we expect a lot of lawsuits challenging how things are processed. Is this a valid vote? Have we seen votes disappearing? Currently, there are more than 200 lawsuits in front of federal and state courts challenging how various states are doing things. And with regard and how they're managing the voting this cycle. One of those cases, by the way, to sort of give you how confusing it is, Pennsylvania. Pennsylvania Supreme Court 10 days ago decided, well, with all of these problems and everything else, we're going to expand the time you can vote. You can vote in person or by mail-in, not just November 3rd, but on the 4th, the 5th, the 6th, and the 7th. 4 days of voting. So Pennsylvania, a major battleground state, we're not going to know for the better part of a week who won. And that case is people are countersuing on that, and it's going to go to the U.S. Supreme Court. Who are they going to be able to decide that between now and the election? I mean, the U.S. Supreme Court is getting jammed, and these things are coming at them, and they're going to be even more jammed afterwards. So buckle up, hold on. We'll get through this. If we can get through the last, 10 months of COVID, we can get through this. But we do expect that there's going to be significant delays, prolonged week after week delays, and a lot of hot tempers. But I think most Americans are going to be pretty cool about that. Then we get into next year. What will happen? I think it's hard to tell, right? Biden wins, Trump wins. Senate goes Democrat, Senate stays Republican. I think, quite frankly, from a market perspective, Trump, either with Trump or Biden, the key thing is the Senate stays Republican. That will be the most market positive. I think a couple things that are from a market perspective that are going to be important. There's going to be more stimulus next year, particularly we predict a massive infrastructure bill early next year, whether it's Biden or Trump, around the $4 trillion mark and probably even higher. That will be net positive over a long period of time for the economy. And interestingly enough, a key component of it, massive component of that infrastructure will be building out broadband and making it bigger and better in the U.S. This is a competitive issue now. It's not a question that we just kind of would like it. Huawei and their presenting of the 5G network globally, it's our Sputnik moment of this time, right? When the Russians beat us into space, how do the Chinese have 5G capability they can sell to anybody in the world, and we, the tech capital of the world, supposedly, we're way behind? We have to catch up, and we have to do this for competitiveness, and it's going to be fascinating to see how that plays out. Anyway, I've talked to you for about 20 minutes or so. Scott, I'm sure you've got a ton of questions and happy to see if I can sort of wade through any of this.
Frank, that's thank you so much. And that's that was fantastic and good overview and certainly a lot to digest. So I do have a handful of questions. Some of them you touched on, but I figured we could just start with sort of where we wrapped up the day yesterday, and I'll come back to this. But we talked about stimulus, or you mentioned stimulus, and I've seen some tweets today going back and forth. But you know, one of the things you mentioned was around Supreme Court justice and Trump getting, you know, Amy Coney Barrett through, and Lindsey Graham coming in here to get an assist, and that might help his campaign. But you know, could you talk about that a little bit? And then also, you know, one of the other thoughts that is out there, I think, is that if that does go through, you know, do the Democrats intend, or do they try to pack the court? I know it came up last week in the debate. I know there hasn't really been an answer to that, but that's one of the theories or thoughts that's out there. If you could kind of touch on both of those, I think that'd be great.
Sure. I would put it at 80-85% certainty that Barrett is confirmed before the election, which means she's seated as a justice November 10th, when one of the biggest healthcare cases hits the Supreme Court. Many people predict it could be the death knell of Obamacare as we know it. Meaning next year, once the decision comes down, they'll hand the decision down in the spring. That means we will have a major healthcare debate next summer, regardless of who's sitting in the White House, because they're going to have to address national healthcare as an issue. Barrett, I think, actually helps Senate Republicans. She helps Joni Ernst in Iowa. She helps, as I mentioned, Lindsey Graham. She helps Tom Tillis. It energizes conservatives, energizes Republicans. And let's face it, guys, we've been through Kavanaugh, and even Gorsuch got it. Can get pretty hairy from the sort of fringes on the other side. They're going to come hard at her in opposition. And I think that really energizes, again, the Republicans and conservatives who maybe get tired or even sitting out or flirting with the idea of voting for Biden or whatever. It pulls them sort of back in. So I think that's sort of a net positive. For Trump, it's a little tougher to see what the positive is, other than it helps him with Catholics, particularly in Wisconsin, Michigan, you know, Ohio, Pennsylvania, the traditional Reagan Democrat, right? They're the ethnic Catholic, which is an enormous, absolutely critical vote. And increasingly, it's the Latino vote, right? But it's the Catholic vote, which is enormous. She, you know, a mother of seven, two beautiful adopted children from Haiti, and an adorable Downs child as her youngest. I mean, you got to say, for Republicans, they're sort of excited to get her out on the stage in the confirmation hearing, because they think this also could appeal to suburban mothers. If you think about it for a moment, aside from her being a Supreme Court, if she wasn't, if you were rolling her out as the new CEO of a Fortune 50 company, of the successful working mother, got these seven beautiful kids, a special needs child, your husband's a successful attorney, and these kids, everything, and you're top of your class. I mean, you're the best of the best. If they can turn that sort of idea as a judge, a Supreme Court judge, they think that will be really good for the Republican Party overall. We'll see how that plays.
Great. Anything on packing the court or what, you know,
packing the court.
That's out there.
Sorry, Scott. Yeah.
Yeah, no problem. No problem.
No, this is real. No, this is very, very real. Democrats, and particularly the progressive left, the Elizabeth Warren, Bernie Sanders guys, they are really banging the table for this. I think Biden is concerned about it. And Biden has said to people, okay, when does this end? We put three in, and the Republicans take the Senate, and they put three in. And then, you know, what do we end up with? A football stadium of Supreme Court justices? I don't think that holds the line, though, on that, because they're going to demand it, and they can get it done. And I think that's going to really rip up America. I think Americans are just like, wait a minute, you changed the goalposts here and you moved them closer because you didn't like what you got. And this is disrespectful to democracy. There'll be a lot of other people who see it the other way. I think Biden really went out of his way, and he didn't handle it well, dodging the question during the debate. Interestingly, for Republicans, that was the way they heard it was, he's dodging this because he's going to do it and support it. But very interestingly, from the progressive left, it was the complete opposite. He's dodging this answer because he doesn't want to do it. Boy, that ticks us off because we expect him to do it. Ooh, wow. You know, sometimes standing in the middle of the street is the most dangerous place to be. You know, you're getting cars going to hit you from both sides. And I think and that comes out in the debates tonight and why the vice presidential debate tonight is going to be really important. Most vice presidential debates, I've done this for 30 years. Yeah, I've skipped a bunch of them because they didn't matter. This one really matters because we're going to get into that issue. We're going to get into, again, Republicans attacking, and Pence, I think, will be methodical about this, attacking Kamala Harris. You are part of that progressive left-wing Bernie Sanders thing. You campaign as president against fracking. You said you'd end fracking day one if you were president. It's hundreds of thousands of jobs in Ohio and Pennsylvania. So where are you now? You want a Medicare for all, not just Obamacare. So where are you now? And because Biden isn't taking those stances, are you going to be in there advocating with him, right? So this is what the Trump campaign strategy is. Yeah, Joe Biden's a centrist, but we want to paint him as a guy who's going to be completely surrounded by these other guys. It will be interesting to see if they are successful in that mission tonight.
That's great. And Frank, so let's stay on that topic because I was going to bring that up and you mentioned that before. So the vice presidential debate, I totally agree. It's something that, you know, I think it's must-see TV tonight and people are talking about it like, wow, this is something everybody has to see. I mean, what do you think the goals are for both candidates? I think, you know, you get Pence on there who's kind of leading the virus response, and I guess he'll speak to that and be able to speak to that. And then, you know, what do you think Harris does here? Does she try to pivot toward the center a little bit and stay in line with Biden, or she'd kind of try to appease the base and get a little bit more left, or what do you think their goals are, and how do you see this playing out tonight?
I think she tries to be as noncommittal as possible, because I think what's we're missing here in the analysis in the press is that it's a fragile relationship between the progressive left wing, the Sanders Warren wing, and the centrist Democrats. We saw Bernie Sanders 2 or 3 weeks ago do the classic move of allowing himself to be interviewed by the New York Times and then later the Washington Post in the third person. And in those interviews, it was Bernie's really not happy that Joe is not embracing more progressive economic policies. Bernie's really worried that Joe's going to lose the election. That wasn't sour grapes. It was kind of a little bit of a dagger thrust at Joe. You'd better start embracing this because, you know, my folks aren't 100% sold on you. And the energy gap in terms of support for Biden is not very, it's just not there. I mean, it's there, but it's not like, you know, if you're for Trump, you're hyper for him. If you're for Joe, you're not hyper for him. You're just hyper against Trump by and large. So you gotta, how Harris deals with that, I don't know. She's gonna have to be very careful not to alienate either side, the centrist or the progressive left. But she goes after Pence over his handling of COVID, over the lack of Republicans attacking Obamacare, but what's the Republican plan? There's just not one that they've put out. It's any number of issues and trying to force Pence to defend Trump. And, you know, what's wrong with you? You know, this, you claim blah, blah, blah. You can see that's going to be the line. And she's a former prosecutor. She's probably going to be very good at that. So that's where she goes. And then, as I mentioned, this is where Pence goes on the other side. But I expect, I'd be surprised if it's not quite a content-rich discussion, right, where you're really getting into this. And unlike the last debate where Chris Wallace, son of Mike Wallace, released in advance, here are the topics I'm going to cover, the moderators tonight have not told anybody what they're planning on asking. So these guys, both Harris and Pence, are walking in a little blind to it.
Yeah, interesting, really interesting stuff. So yeah, thanks for that. Let me just circle back, if I could, to the stimulus package. So it seemed like yesterday, you know, that deal was off, and we're moving on, and we're gonna try to get the Supreme Court justice in here, and then this morning I'm watching some texts going back and forth that Trump's trying to possibly reopen conversation there. I mean, there are any thoughts on a stimulus package getting done at this point after yesterday, and or does it seem like a long shot? I mean, and who wins, who loses there? I mean, it seems like a lose-lose, but what's your thoughts on that?
Well, it's an ongoing blame game, right? So, but let's look at the facts. The Senate Republicans passed their last stimulus was $500 billion, and they barely got, I think there were two Republicans that wouldn't even vote for it, and the rest of them held their nose. They didn't want to do it. That was their version. The Senate, their last bill that they passed like 5 months ago, the HEROES Act, was $3.5 trillion. So we're talking a $3 trillion variance to start. We're now down where Pelosi's at 2.2. The White House is at 1.5, and the U.S. Senate Republicans haven't even been brought into the room to negotiate. So the negotiations blew up between the administration and Pelosi. The administration doesn't speak for the Senate Republicans, right? They're not just sort of standing by taking orders here, and they're not going to go above a trillion, and they really, really, really don't want to go past half a billion. So even there's a variance now of $1 trillion between the White House and Senate Republicans. What you're seeing now, though, is, to be very clear, Trump saying, we don't need this big package, we need one-offs, which is actually a very, I think, probably a very smart idea that people will gravitate to and support, but it's also politically very cunning and smart, right? Let's do a one-shot package here to help the airline industry. Let's now do a separate package that helps the hotel industry. Pelosi can't get that passed in the House because the progressive left guys say, whoa, no. Our $3.5 trillion one really helped the poorest of the poor, those most in needy. You do these one-off things, they get left behind. No, we're not supporting it. And it risks fracturing her caucus, the Democratic caucus, if she puts that up, because all the Republicans will vote for it. The moderates will vote for it. Progressive left won't. She's not going to do that 3 weeks before the election, 4 weeks before the election, and nor will Republicans do it if there's a bigger $1.5 trillion package, because they'll get a lot of Republican senators who will say, even to what the administration initially was moving towards agreeing with Pelosi, they're not going to agree to a $1.5 to $2 trillion. They're just not going to do it. So I just don't see how they get out of this box.
Yeah, really, really, really interesting stuff. So, the landscape just continues to be interesting. So I got one or two more if you've got time.
Yeah.
I know we're wrapping up here almost at about 40 minutes in, so I want to be cognizant of your time and everybody on the phone here who has other things to get to as well. So just walk me through, you know, swing states. You mentioned them, Pennsylvania, Michigan, Wisconsin, Florida, Arizona, North Carolina, Ohio. I mean, are they all too close to calls, or do you have any thoughts or feel which way they'll go? You know, what Trump did well last time. I mean, what are his folks saying? He uses all this technology. I know he's data driven. You know, what are your thoughts on the swing states, and what do you think the outcomes are there?
It's interesting. I think Ohio, which has always been the bellwether for so many years of presidentials, you're not talking about it so much. It's more Florida and Pennsylvania. I think Ohio, though, is leaning Trump. And Pennsylvania, a jump ball. I mean, remember, Biden's from Pennsylvania, but this fracking issue could be a killer for Biden there. Killer. Florida's tough because you've got a large Latino community, right? And you've got a huge Puerto Rican community. And Trump hasn't been real nice towards Puerto Rico since the crisis that they've had down there, right? The hurricanes and stuff. He's now put in more aid and everything else, but a lot of those people fled and have gone to Florida, and that's impactful. But that being said, and despite Mike Bloomberg personally putting in $100 million into the campaign in Florida, we're not seeing Biden breaking away from Trump. And seeing the last one, I think there was new polls out today, but I haven't looked at. But as of yesterday, it was, I think, a 1.1 lead for Biden. Well, that's well within the margin of error. So I think that's too close to call. So in those three. And then North Carolina, it's going to be hard for Trump to win. But I had a conversation with a Trump campaign guy, long conversation on Saturday. They think they've got a real shot at winning Minnesota. They think they're closer and they pull off Wisconsin, even though poll numbers there have suggested Biden's up by 5. So it's a long way of saying they're sort of up, down, up, down. But I think the next 3 weeks before 27 days, it's going to be so concentrated, and you will begin to see some shifts and real hardening, and we're going to know.
Yeah, really interesting. And thanks for that. So I got one, maybe two more. This one just kind of came in. I like this question. So can you just give us your thoughts around each candidate, if Trump wins or if Biden wins, what happens in relations with U.S. and China? Let's play it out over the next couple of years. If the Biden camp wins, how do they approach China? And then if Trump gets reelected here, you know, I think it's more the same, but how that plays out over the next couple of years as well. But if you could share a couple of thoughts on that, that'd be great.
Sure, Scott. You know, what's fascinating is it's the one issue that doesn't come up between them. You didn't hear anything about China during the Democratic presidential convention. It wasn't mentioned once. You only heard about it from the Republican one, and Trump was talking about how tough he's been on China. They are strategically in agreement. They are strategically in agreement on China and unfair trade practices and need to be tougher with them. Now, tactically, it will be very different. Trump will continue doing what he does, and he particularly focused on the trade side, though he's increasingly been focusing on human rights issues. And because the other big thing has changed in the last 4 years, China has a much bigger, much more powerful military, which they've been spending enormous amounts of money to develop, right? I think there are 3-4 aircraft carriers with massive amounts of support ships. I think there's 2 more aircraft carriers coming online. That gives the Chinese ability to project their military forces anywhere in the world. Where it used to be 4 or 5 years ago, it was just all about defending their own coast. This is problematic throughout all Asia Pacific, and it's got every Asian Pacific country turning to the U.S. sort of with pleading eyes, like, look, we need to do business with these guys, but we're worried. None more so than India. And you've seen Trump really develop relations with India over the last few years, not just economic, but political and increasingly military. I think if Biden were to win, you're going to continue to see exactly what Trump's done. He's going to be very tough on them, right? I mean, core to the Democratic Party is union members who have seen their work going over there. The tech community, Silicon Valley, which is heavily Democratic, going crazy with hacking and intellectual property theft. And first and foremost, you're going to see a refocus where human rights becomes a dominant issue in dealing with them, with China. Meaning, you guys want us to lift these tariffs? Tell us what you're going to do to improve human rights in Hong Kong. Tell us what you're going to do and act upon to improve human rights with the Uyghur Muslim population or in Tibet, right? Ooh, boy, that's not going to go down well with the Chinese. That's not going to go down as, but they're going to do it. And I would expect Biden rejoins the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Trump pulled out of it. Even still, you can see a series of bilateral new trade deals there. Asia is the future. India is the next big, huge ally of the United States. And you're going to have, over the next 2 to 5 to 10 years, even, an increasingly hostile, tough relationship with China. Which a country which has become just shockingly bellicose and warlike in some of their commentary, that their diplomats around the world proudly refer to themselves as wolf warriors. This is based off of this movie where a bunch of, you know, beleaguered Chinese soldiers kill a bunch of American mercenaries, believe it or not, right? One of the biggest money-making movies in Chinese history. They call themselves the wolf warriors. And you look at the diplomats around the world, their ambassadors to Germany, the UK, elsewhere. They are not diplomatic in their speech anymore. I've never seen anything like it. So this is the new normal. But it does beg the question, though, Scott, sorry for belaboring this. Mm-hmm. What is wrong inside China? There's something we're missing. We look at the economic data constantly, but we don't seem to understand the society and the politics. Why did President Xi muscle his way in and become president for life? That's not the way the party has worked since Mao founded the party. Why this hyper-nationalism? I think there's a multitude of reasons, right? Income inequality is a massive one. But I also suspect there's an anger among the population at Beijing because of corruption, which is unbelievable. It's indescribable. And with COVID, the way the government handled it, there's no way the death rate numbers that they've officially put out are correct. And everybody knows it, right? They're probably 10 times higher. And what sort of anger and societal unrest is brewing? Because when a country and the political leadership start waving the flag as in a nationalist way, and if you look at China, they're attacking every major Western economy, the EU, the UK, the US, Australia, India. I mean, they've started shooting skirmishes with the Indian Army out of nowhere. Why? There's got to be a reason why, and something has changed, and it's changed radically in the last six months to a year.
Yeah, really, really good points, spot on. So good stuff there. One last one, if you don't mind. Is there anything else maybe you think is important we're not really talking about, or maybe you think it's a little bit undercovered? You know, there's also this rumor out there that Biden, you know, if he does win here, and does he finish his first term? Does he go for a second term? Does he maybe hand the reins over to Kamala? I mean, what's your thoughts on that? Is there anything else that maybe we're just not thinking about that maybe going a little bit undercovered in this political world?
Well, look, you know, one, I think there's just people are freaking out, right? People are freaking out, and they need to stay close with one another, be calm. This is a strong democracy. Work with your financial advisors if you're working with your doctor, because this is the moment that you can really trust, right? You want to be in good shape if you're nervous. Just make sure you're well positioned and everything else. I think this is a great time to review all that stuff. I also, look, I can't speak to Biden's health. I don't know. I've worked around Joe Biden for 30 years. Yeah, he's slowed down a little bit, but he's 77 years old. Yeah, he makes gaffes, but he always made gaffes, maybe more gaffes now than ever. I can't imagine him stepping down, letting Kamala be president. I don't see that happening. But I think there's bigger things here, too, that we need to watch. One, the China situation. This is life-changing. This is going to be, for our children, our children's children, a new world here, whether it's, you know, are we entering in a new Cold War? And then there's so many other things that are out there that are fascinating to watch. Scott, I got to talk about this one because people think I'm nuts when I raise this. Donald Trump created a brand new branch of the military, equal to the Army, Navy, Air Force, and Marine Corps, Space Force. Well, everybody laughs at it and mocks it because, Steve Carell's got that hilarious show on Netflix. Okay, let's be serious for a minute. What are we talking about? We are literally talking about a military Space Force, Star Wars, the movie, but it's real. They are developing spaceships. They're developing flying cars. They're doing... This is the money that is being poured into this is mind blowing. I would point to the fact that, you know, Elon Musk has got Tesla and everybody's fascinated or loves his cars. I'm going to bet you in 10 to 15 years, that's a sideshow compared to where his real passion is. He is all about the first Space Force spaceship, successful takeoff landing. And it looked like something out of Star Wars was It happened about 2 months ago. I say all of this because, again, not to be weird, there's going to be massive, indescribable commercial and personal implications of this. It's going to transform our lives. So while we're sort of bogged down with all of this stuff of COVID and the politics and everything else, everything else is advancing here. And there's tremendous opportunities. And it's whether it's investment, Space Force, sort of work that through. Think about it for 20 minutes. As you're sitting there, what does that mean? Study it. Look at it. This is amazing. Colonizing Mars is not some aspirational thing. This is what we're talking about. This is fascinating to me. And I think that's what we're missing is some of the bigger things out there and how the world will deal with China and the U.S. will respond. We won't be secondary to China. We will create broadband that's 5G, 6G, 7G, because we've had this Sputnik moment. The Chinese have gotten past us. We will now come back. And I think that's what's really fascinating. People have to sort of keep their eye on that prize.
It's awesome. And yeah, well said. And that is something good to think about for sure. So let me just kind of break the call here and say, number one, thank you, Frank, for your time. I want to thank everybody that joined us. Certainly a lot to think about when you start just continuously looking at our political landscape today. And like I started, it's more polarizing than ever. But you know, there's a VP debate, which a lot of folks will turn into tonight. But thank you guys for joining us today on a sunny afternoon on the East Coast in the middle of the day. And, you know, hopefully for all the clients on the line, you follow up with your advisor. You've got a lot of information out of this that you can have a conversation with him or her and decide, you know, what do we do and how does this impact us? And for everybody else on the line, if you're interested in receiving more of Frank's content, we do have podcasts, we have white papers, we have other materials we can share with you that we can get to you if you want to hear more around some of the things Frank's talking about on a regular basis. So thanks to everybody for joining today. Thank you, Frank, for all your comments and thoughts. And with that, operator, we will end the call. Thank you very much and have a great day.
Thank you, everybody.